Wisconsin has more than 400 cases of COVID-19. 5 Wisconsinites have died from the disease. There have also been thousands of negative tests for COVID-19. Today, Governor Evers announced there would be a safer-at-home order that goes into effect tomorrow, saying it was necessary to help slow down the spread of the virus. We know you have questions as the disease continues to spread and efforts to slow it down kick into high gear. We've been getting a lot of questions from listeners through our Why Wisconsin portal on Facebook and email and, of course, in calls to our talk shows here on the Ideas Network. So right now, a doctor and public health expert joins us to answer some of those questions. You can also call in now with your questions about the novel coronavirus and COVID-19 and public health measures. Are you wondering about the symptoms or the spread, the public health response, how our state's healthcare system is getting ready for the pandemic? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thanks, Rob.
Well, Dr. Remington, some of the most frequent questions we've been getting are about testing. As you're watching things, what's the status of the number of tests we have available, the labs we have to process them, and the people who need them?
Well, we clearly, as a country, we're not prepared to test as many people as we should have been. One of the most important things early in an epidemic is to not only test people who are symptomatic, but also test people who might be exposed to people with symptoms so we can learn more about the ability of the virus to spread and also the seriousness of the virus. So other countries had more test kits available. Korea, for example, is testing 6 to 10 times more people per capita than we are. And they were way ahead of the curve on knowing more about the virus and really to be able to do what we call sort of public health 101, which is to identify cases, diagnose them through a test, but then follow up aggressively on their contacts, test them also to learn whether they've become infected, and then you can implement isolation and quarantine measures much more intelligently, and we're just playing catch up.
Right. It seems like the countries where we've seen success stories, China after some initial shortcomings, South Korea, as you mentioned, parts of Italy that seem to be doing better. It seems like the common thread, at least according to some public health experts I've read, is, as you said, lots of testing and then isolation. Is it too late for that here now, or is there still room for us if we can ramp things up to replicate what appears to have been successful elsewhere?
No, it's definitely not too late. I think one of the reasons for the stay-at-home or safer-at-home order is to give us time to increase the number of tests. The production of testing has been ramping up, not just through public health laboratories, but private laboratories. So we're seeing a rapid increase in testing. Now, just a caution, when you see a spike in the number of diagnosed cases, that can be from the disease spreading, but it can also be from just more testing. So in places that have ramped up testing, you might see what appears to be a spike in the actual transmission, but that's just more testing. But it's definitely not too late. But to give us time, people should really reduce the risk of transmission by staying home and not going to crowded meetings and using this concept of social isolation.
And before we go to our callers at 800-642-1234, there is some pushback I see, you know, on social media and the media and elsewhere saying this isn't that big a deal. It's a flu, something like that. We're overreacting. How would you address that kind of concern?
We are not overreacting. We are reacting. Given the lack of preparedness, it may appear to be overreacting, but we don't really have the public health infrastructure in place to respond like other countries, and we didn't have the capacity in the area of testing. And it doesn't do any good to look back and say that we should have or could have done better. Now is the time to use social isolation to buy us time to have improved testing and also help build back the public health infrastructure. Our local health departments, state health departments have been struggling with declining budgets, and we just can't do that and be prepared for the next pandemic. We have to learn from this lesson and come into it much better prepared.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We'll start with Fawn on the line in Madison. Fawn, hello.
Callers now at 800-642-1234. We'll start with
Fawn, are you there?
Fawn, hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, turn your radio down, though, Fawn.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, go for it.
Hi, yes. There's been so much misinformation. I've seen all kinds all over social media, like lots and lots of myths. One of the things that, and some of them I've been able to dispel with the help of Snopes, but I wonder about this one. Just how tenacious is the virus? Can it spread? Can it live on our clothes and be carried as we come in from outdoors, for example? If we encounter it out of doors, should we immediately take all our clothes off and wash it? Wash the clothes in hot water, cold water? Should we take a shower immediately? And if we can't wash the clothes, then we should set them outside in the sunlight to be neutralized by the UV rays. Can you
gotcha.
Say something about that?
That's a question. I mean, I've wondered myself, Fawn. Thanks for calling in, Dr. Remington. Do we know at this point how the virus can stay alive or stick around on clothing and whether it can be transmitted that way?
Well, we do know that the virus lasts some time on surfaces. If a person were ill and coughed or sneezed, that surface in front of them could contain the virus, and it can last several hours. But whether you can, and there, I've seen these reports that you can find it 9 days later, whether you can recover a virus 9 days later doesn't mean that it's going to be viable and likely to cause infection. I like to think about it as there's no 100% yes and 0% no. There's grades of risk. And if you're a healthcare provider and doing the great work that we need from healthcare providers and taking care of sick patients, you're going to be exposed to the virus, and you're going to do very careful precautions to not carry that virus from room to room or home with you. But if you're in at home and you're going out and going for a walk, or even going shopping at a grocery store, the chance of being exposed to a virus is extremely small, but it's reasonable when you touch surfaces that may not have been clean that you wash your hands. And if you do have surfaces that you've shared with others, like a cell phone, that you do disinfect it. But again, it's not to the point that the virus is living on all possible surfaces outdoors and in places where people have not been ill.
Thanks for that call, Fawn, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health is with us answering your questions about COVID-19 and public health measures. Back to your calls now. Ron is with us in Ridgeville. Ron, hello.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Robin. I'm sorry. Hi, Robin, to your guest. I've got a question about the use of hand sanitizers and these other liquids that we're using to treat surfaces. Can this virus eventually, or could it, potential to create resistance to these things that we're using?
Interesting. Thanks for that call, Dr. Remington. Can a virus evolve resistance to these to alcohol?
No, they can't. Viruses, in order to change and to mutate, which they do, this virus mutates probably every two or three times it infects a population, maybe every 2 weeks or so. But those mutations so far have not changed the characteristic of the virus or yet. We don't see a change in its sort of immune receptor. And we think, therefore, it at least the evidence is right as of today that that isn't the type of mutation that might make it less remedied by a vaccine. But disinfectants kill the virus. They're not replicating outside of a human, and so there's no chance of resistance. The virus will dry and die within a couple of hours, but disinfectants can kill it much quicker.
Thanks for that call. And people might think of antibacterial soaps, which has nothing to do with viruses, but it is true, right, that use of antibacterial soaps, bacteria sometimes could develop resistances. Is that right?
That's true, because they're replicating on a surface or on a contaminated product in a contaminated product. And that's different. Viruses are not replicating outside of a human host. So that is true. Certainly the use of antibiotics within people or within animals can lead to resistance, but it's not the case for viruses.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Tyler with us in Appleton. Tyler, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I have two questions. One is, do you think that it, or what do you think the possibilities of the American public receiving the remdesivir and the chloroquine as possible treatments? And also, do you foresee any problems with the potential patents that are with the COVID-19 testing kits and even with the virus itself?
Thanks for that call, Tyler. Dr. Remington, let's start with a couple drugs that people are talking about. Other countries are trying here in the U.S. We're experimenting with them, I think.
Well, I take my advice from Tony Fauci, who's really one of the most knowledgeable people in this country. And his view and the view of many others is that the information on these two drugs is anecdotal. That means there's some promising anecdotal information, but it's not in from a clinical trial, and it's not really yet to the point where there's any evidence that these drugs are effective. We need to take anecdotal evidence and put it into a clinical trial so that we know if these drugs can be effective. And certainly we don't want to be using drugs unnecessarily. There can be harm to these medicines and their costs. So I think it's better to let the science lead on what treatments are effective and really listen to our National Institutes of Health and the researchers who are going to let us know what treatments in a very carefully clinical controlled trial are likely to be effective. I wouldn't take anecdotal information and go out and try and get a prescription to either of these medicines.
And the scary thing there is I'm seeing accounts of people who take those medicines for conditions they are proven for, tested for. Now, because of the talk of these as a hypothetical coronavirus treatment, they're not able to get the medicines that they actually need, and we know they work.
Yeah, and to go back to your first caller, there's so much misinformation out there. I just recommend that people go to credible sources, go to the CDC or your state or local health department, and really get identify your sources from well-known and well-regarded organizations, and not just from a Facebook posting that you might have seen.
We continue our talk with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, answering your questions about COVID-19 and the novel coronavirus that causes it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Briefly, Dr. Remington, before we go back to our callers, one thing that's tricky in some cases with selling the need for social distancing is that, if I'm understanding this correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, the things we're doing today are going to pay off or not in 10 to 14 days. What we're seeing now with the spread all has to do with what we did 2 weeks ago. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. The virus from the point of infection takes about 4.5 to 5.5 days to develop illness. And then that person, once ill, I actually was shedding virus prior to symptoms. So anything we do today is really going to be seen downstream a week or two from now.
Let's go back to our callers. Andy is on the line in Marinette. Andy, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Andy?
Yes, I'm wondering. Okay, so I just came back from Chicago, which I know is a known hotspot, and I came back 2 weeks ago, which was a little bit ahead of the curve. I knew there was some issues, and I made the decision to self-isolate back then. And so I watched all of the activity around me deny that this was an issue and continue to go about their daily lives. And my question is, what is the exponential factor that we can expect from if we make a decision today to self-isolate or if we make a decision today to go out in public? How many people can we expect to show symptoms down the line if we don't change anything versus if we do?
Dr. Remington, what do you think?
Yeah. That's a great question. If all you have to do is open up a spreadsheet and practice this, just double a number. Within a month, taking a penny and doubling it every day, you're going to have over $20 million in a month. But do that with cases. Take a case and double it every 5 days, which is what we see, you'll have 10 million cases in 3 months. And so if we do nothing, it's well known that there will be millions of people dying in this country. And so that is really not an option. If we do a good job of social isolation, we're going to buy time. We might not prevent as many cases as occurring as we'd like, but we're going to buy time so those serious cases are able to get appropriate medical care. So there are hospital beds and ventilators, if necessary, available to them. If you continue going out and socializing as you did before, you're increasing the risk not only for yourself, but to transmit that disease to others, and we will exceed the capacity of hospitals to take care of really sick people. And so it really is important to be safe, to follow all the precautions that are being recommended. This is not an overblown response. This is the appropriate response given where we are today.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Ed now in Kearney, Michigan. Ed, hello. Ed, are you there? Doesn't sound like we have Ed. Let's switch over to Dean then in Rushford, Minnesota. Dean, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi,
hey, hey.
Thank you for taking my call. So, like I was speaking to you earlier, I live in southeast Minnesota, and I work over the river in Wisconsin. And it's just kind of disturbing, you know, the sentiment and just the overall attitude I get from people about this is that, you know, like, this is just another flu-like thing that, you know, it's going to come and go. And it's just, like, boggles me that we're not, that people aren't grasping the gravity of this. So I'm just wondering, you know, what can we do to really get people to understand the gravity of the situation? Because, I mean, you'd think with all the measures that, you know, we're trying to take now, people would understand. But it really, just from the people I deal with and I speak to, they just don't really understand what's going on. So just, it's kind of disturbing.
Dean, thanks for the call. A big part of this, I guess, is communication, Dr. Remington.
It is, and it's at both ends of the spectrum. I think we clearly need to convince people that this is not business as usual, that this is a very serious virus. It can kill 1 out of 5 people over 80 years of age, and it can also kill young people, although less commonly. It will become the leading cause of death in people in their 30s if we don't respond. So it is clearly a public health emergency, and we need to respond. Now, that being said, I think there are people who are very afraid and are maybe overreacting by not leaving their house, by not even going shopping and doing things that you can do safely. If you keep a distance from individuals and if you use safe hand washing and other practices, you can go about that business. But again, avoid large crowds. I think the stay-at-home order is a good way to see if we can buy some time to really bring this epidemic under control so that we make sure we have enough capacity within our hospitals and healthcare system to take care of people who will become really sick. We have not seen the end of this. It's still an epidemic in process.
Time for one more caller. Rick is with us in New Glarus. Rick, hello.
Hi, Pat. I've got a childhood acquaintance of yours from Dartmouth Road. I'm an ER doc. And I, on my ER doc sites, I'm seeing a lot of apprehension from staff, especially in the hardest areas in New York and California and Washington, having observed in Italy that the system has overwhelmed not only from equipment, but personal and humanitarian or human resource side of this. How much are you aware of that, and what's your assessment of how the system, if it becomes more prevalent and it develops as we think it might, what's your assessment of the human resource side of this, nurses, doctors, and can we handle
it? Rick, thanks for the call. Dr. Remington.
Well, I think that's a good way to end this conversation. We need to really respect our people working at the front lines. Rick, you know, as an emergency medicine physician, and all the staff involved, those are the people who are really going into harm's way, exposing themselves to the risk of caring for these patients. And I have the greatest respect for people working at the front lines. We need to do everything we can to make sure that our behavior is helping them by staying away from other people, by reducing the chances of us ourselves getting sick, so that the healthcare providers can do the best job that they can. And we absolutely need to make sure that they have all the protective equipment and that they have all the support needed. And that partly is not being prepared is too bad, but it's even worse if we don't help people right now at the front line doing everything that we can.
Dr. Remington, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He was with us to help answer some of your questions about the novel coronavirus and COVID-19. You can keep submitting your questions by emailing ideas at WPR.org, or you can go to WPR.org and click on Why Wisconsin. Leave your questions there.